Professor Douglas Davis is my latest nostalgia interview guest. It was a great pleasure to meet Douglas when I was in Durham over the course of Easter 2019. And I'd never met Douglas before, but I knew one or two of his research students. And it was a pleasure to catch up with him to talk about nostalgia. And this is an interview which takes a slightly different turn to some of my other ones. In this case, we talk quite cerebrally about nostalgia and the problems with nostalgia. We talk about the concept of career planning and its relationship to issues of social class, why Douglas thinks that talk of nostalgia is futile. Luck and chance are the two great facts of life. We talk about the problems with retrospective what-if scenarios, with the problems of the perfect day and the desire for patterns, and why he thinks they are a pathological expression of the drive for meaning. We talk about how people develop their worldviews and the problem with synchronicity. He tells us that films are doing what myths have always done, the overcoming of opposites. We talk about the role of trivial events and how they impact on us, and a stream of consciousness approach to life. We also talk about the problems with revisiting special moments, and Douglas asks whether nostalgia can be a positive evolutionary phenomenon. We also learn why there can be a side of nostalgia which entails engaging with fear, and Douglas brings Durkheim into the discussion in the context of how society lives within us, yet I am me. And we find out why the British don't like apprenticeships. And then at the end of the conversation, we talk about how conventions change, and we talk about the problem with predictive certainty and the what have I learned scenario and its relationship with wisdom. So it was a great pleasure to interview Professor Douglas Davis from the University of Durham for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it is my absolute pleasure to have Professor Douglas Davis here from the University of Durham. And we were just talking before we started that even though I may not sound very Welsh, we obviously come from a very similar neck of the woods. Mm. So I'm from Cardiff originally, and you were saying just north of Cardiff.
Yes. Yeah. My home village is a village called Bedlinog, which is top end of the valleys.
Yeah. And of course, I was at Lampeter for many years. And how long have you been at Durham?
I've been at Durham for 26 years altogether.
Wow.
6 years a long time ago, and yeah. 21 years just now.
Yeah. And do you see any great changes? I mean, not just in Durham itself, but I guess in terms of the way universities have evolved. I mean, I have in my time of being in both Wales and at Kent.
Well, size, I guess, is the big thing. Durham is enormously bigger now than it was when I was an undergraduate here a long time ago. But apart from that, I don't see very many changes, apart from the standard stuff in universities of bureaucratic efficiency and performance and production and publication and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And one thing as well that has been a common thread during the interviews I've done so far is that so many people are first-generation university, or they find that they certainly wouldn't have imagined doing now, or they wouldn't have imagined when they were young what they're doing now. Was that your sort of narrative at all? Was this something that you always imagined that you'd be doing when you were at and beyond university?
No, I don't think I had particular imaginations of that sort. The concept of career planning, I think, is quite modern in relation to issues of social class, because issues of hereditary jobs and occupations really has run across social classes in Britain for a very long time. And I think now more than ever, the idea of people planning a career, which I think is one of the most futile of all activities, basically, because luck and event are the two great facts of life which organisations, from school careers officers through to parents wanting great things for their children if they do, have in mind. Mm. Because luck and chance are the facts of life, and they're the unfortunate facts of life because they can't be planned for. Mm. and all institutions work on the basis of efficient planning. But life is not a planned event. So I think that's quite important, really.
No, and I always find it all, because I teach a module on death and the afterlife, and we're looking at the whole notion of, you know, the unexpected, the chance events. You know, it's easy to go back and think, well, if I followed that path or I adopt that type of behaviour, maybe that wouldn't have happened. But you're right. I mean, the way that we sometimes stumble into particular, not just careers, but, you know, where we go to university, the degree that we do, has a huge impact on where we end up. But we don't always foresee those. But what we often do, which is, I think, the nostalgia interest that I have, is to go back and sometimes say, what if? Maybe that's a mistake sometimes, but what if I'd taken that different path? Would I have ended up in the same place that I'm at now, albeit through a more, you know, via a more circuitous route?
Well, I think that is an inevitability, because as a meaning-making animal, let's take that as the baseline for everything. The consideration of what if that plan rather than another one is something that the human mind will always play with, because it's always playing with patterns, and it is more likely to play with those patterns if it is unhappy with the pattern it's got in the present. So there's a sense in that kind of retrospective what if business is something that some people play a great deal, and my guess is it's because they have more energy, more negative energy, as I would say it, to think about the past, and they have positive energy to think about what they're doing now and into the future.
Yeah.
So there's a big issue there, I think.
Yeah.
It's about the psychology of emotion, and it's about the psychology of emotions within the dynamics of identity.
Yeah, and often I find that it's present experiences, or, you know, the word that's often used in nostalgia, of course, is bittersweet. But if something is imperfect in the present, that often is the catalyst for that. It can be backwards looking, but I guess it can also be forwards looking, because it's almost saying something might have worked once. Do we all find this golden age? Are we all looking for that almost like prelapsarian condition in our own life and circumstances? In some people's case, it might be when they were at university, or they say, well, there was something that fell into place, something has fallen out of place. How can we realign that misalignment? You know, how can we get back onto a more positive and healthy course? And of course then it's inevitable that you start using the language of wholesomeness or redemption or salvation or simply catharsis. Is that something that you would identify with?
No, not really. I think that the desire for patterns is tremendous. That takes the form of thoughts about schemes of salvation within religious traditions, and I suppose is played out most extensively in the, whether it's in the Jewish Christian notion of eras, epochs, dispensations, or whether it's played out in more Eastern notions of eras and ages. The human animal likes that because it brings a sense of significant meaning. It brings a sense of control. And that sense of control, I think, is deeply problematic, and I think has become pathological in contemporary British student world, where being perfect. You see, it's very interesting in Britain, the notion. I had a student who did a PhD on weddings. It was the first real study of how weddings work in the Church of England. And that very concept of my perfect day.
Yeah.
Now, what on earth does it mean to talk about my perfect day? It means many things. Now people might even talk about it a little more, are talking about it a little more, without using the word perfect, because the word perfect is a forbidden word in the world of funerals. But the desire to have a personally organized funeral, to me, symbolically, is in the same logical type of activities as my perfect day of a wedding, or, as some students would want it, the perfect career as an undergraduate, or now as a master's student. That those desires for perfection, I think, are a pathological expression of the drive for meaning, essentially.
Because I do worry sometimes that we have this, when we reach one goal, we attain one goal, we achieve that perfect career or academic goal. We've got that PhD, we've got that job. Of course, what do? We just search for another one. You know, the idea, I mean, in a way that's good because the alternative would be complacency. But I always find, because I've always kept a diary and I've always gone back over some of those events that in my mind I'm thinking, yeah, that would be, you know, that was a really good day. And you look back and you think, yeah, but I was stressed because I had a deadline coming up or I didn't know what life was in front of me. But I've kind of ironed out some of those creases. And I find sometimes that it can be healthy to go back, but as long as you're not imagining or foisting upon the past the idea that all those relationships, all those things that we were doing in day-to-day were actually good for us, because obviously technologies change and the way that we adapt, and you know, there are things that we wouldn't want to give up now. The idea that if somebody said to me you can go back to 1993, part of me would think, oh, that'd be exciting, that was a good year, but also if I went back I'd be standing outside a phone box to speak to my parents every evening. And so it's things like that. There's the trivial as well as, you know, the macro level and the micro level. It seems to be what you're getting at.
Yes. Really, we're talking about worldviews and how people inhabit their worldviews and how they abandon them or forge them or develop them. And it seems to me that if you talk about looking back as a what-if replaying game, it's a game I don't like the rules of, because it introduces notions of self and time that I don't appreciate. I don't find pleasurable. Or more particularly, I don't find sensible. Because in one sense, it's a waste of time to think about the what-ifs, what-if, what-if, what-if. The facts of life, as far as I can see them, are that there are a whole series of accidents and events and things happen. Simply that, things happen. What you do when things happen, that's a big issue, and everyone has to deal with that as best they can. But that's the way it is.
Because sometimes the word serendipity is brought into play, or synchronicity. And I found this. I was once on a train, and I was writing up an old diary entry, and it happened to be the time, it obviously consumed me somewhat, back in the year 2000, when the Labour Party was torn over who should be the London mayor. And there was Frank Dobson, there was Ken Livingstone. Anyway, I happened to be writing up this period and, you know, just getting on with my journey. About 5 minutes later, I saw this man walking towards me from the buffet car. And I thought, he looks a bit like Santa Claus. Or I came a bit closer and I thought, it's Frank Dobson. And it was Frank Dobson. And I'd just been writing about him. But of course, I couldn't say to him, oh, I was just writing about you. I mean, that would just sound really strange. But I've had lots of those. But at the same time, I think it might be a coincidence if I'm listening to a particular piece of music or a particular news event as I'm driving into work, and then I might have a student in my office, and I see that their date of birth, because often it appears on the screen in front of me when the appointment comes through, is the same date that particular event that I was thinking of just 20 minutes earlier happened. And although I think there's obviously meaning in this, I think, but what about all the other occasions when I have students in my office, or I'm sitting on train journeys and writing about, you know, winning the lottery, and that has never happened? So we are mindful, I think, sometimes to pick those isolated cases and seek wider meaning in them.
Well, that is the nature of the human brain. It's what it does. We are, to go back to the point, not just meaning-making, but pattern-seeking. Yeah. It's what it's all about. Yeah. The question is how to acknowledge the meaning-making, pattern-seeking nature of my brain, your brain, everybody's brain, in a positive way and not in a pathological way. Yeah. Because I think that word synchronicity, for example, will be used 9 times out of 10 by someone who's read 1/100th of a half a book by Carl Jung.
Yeah.
Why that concept synchronicity has then come to be used by them seems to me to be exactly the same way as in 1980s Israel, vast numbers of people were going to palm readers, soothsayers of all shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
But they were. But not to spiritualists. Whereas in Britain, at that point, that kind of influence wasn't there, but we know full well that after the First War, a lot of them would have been going to spiritualists. So the pattern books vary a great deal, and that, I suppose, is the task of the study of religion, to see how precisely that works, the desire to see agency in the world, that God is in control, that predestination works, that the fates have their forces. All these are, as it were, manifestly evident games that the brain plays, and which cognitive psychology and cognitive anthropology are now showing us more than ever.
Yeah, and I often find that when you watch a film in which this sort of notion of destiny, or I think of Mr. Destiny, only you, you know, the idea that there is somebody out there who is our perfect soulmate. And I wonder, when we watch these, that actually, rather than sometimes think, oh yeah, that's what we want, that's the answer that we're seeking, it actually works the other way. I mean, John Lydon is somebody who works in the religion and film field where I did a lot of my research. And it's interesting, because sometimes it gives us these false expectations. And sometimes when we watch these films, we think, but why isn't my life like that? And it's almost as though we're expecting them that somehow through these films, if that order is not in our life, then there's something missing. But actually, in many cases, what happens when we don't have those perfect relationships? And often in the movies, the happy ever after syndrome is very much present. And then sometimes the actors in these films, of course, have the most terribly dysfunctional lives. So what, you know, our role models seem, you know, magazines are looking out for relationship breakups, but the films are often talking about wholeness and togetherness and life after, life together afterness.
So quite, but in that sense, films are just doing what myths always do, which is, and this takes us back to, not only, of course, but it certainly does take us back to good Claude Lévi-Strauss and his arguments on myth and the overcoming of opposites. It's what myths do. And it's what myths do in an interesting kind of way. I mean, if we were to look at this conceptually, what I think is extremely interesting, because you used the word destiny a moment ago, is to look at the way in which and it's something I pursued in a series of books fairly recently, is the way in which the world is absolutely full of ideas, names for things, for example. But there's a relatively small number of ideas that become infected with or pervaded by emotions. Now, I think that when an idea becomes pervaded by an emotion, you get a value. Politicians are always talking about British values, they never define them. And what British values are, actually, are ideas that, for a variety of reasons, people are attached to emotionally. I don't like cricket particularly, so I'm not attached to it. It's an idea to me, it's not a value to me. Now, to others, it will be definitely a value. But I think that you can take this line of thought much further, and you can say that when a value contributes to a person's sense of identity, then you have a belief. That's what beliefs are. They are ideas filled with emotion that give a sense of identity. And that's great, and that applies to all of us, basically. But historically, there's been the next step, the fourth step in this progression of thought. And it is that when that kind of belief contributes to a person's sense of destiny, then you have religious belief. Now, historically, this has been, for most cultures, the way things have worked. The interesting thing about what we now describe as secular world, a secularization process or something like that, is that actually a sense of destiny has been removed from the meaning-making processes. The people are left with identities, but not with destinies. And that's what this vague concept of spirituality is about. Spirituality is about identity minus destiny. What is extraordinarily interesting, indeed only over the last couple of months, is the way in which, for example, sixth formers, school children, have been coming out on Fridays opposing government ignorance, lack of action, on global warming, on ecological factors. And what is, to me, extremely interesting is that there's a sense in which that issue, analytically speaking, is a destiny factor. Because when people talk, as often they do, about saving the world, what they really mean is saving humanity. The world couldn't care less. When we're all dead and gone in about 5,000 years' time, the grass will grow, the beetles will crawl, and it'll be beautiful again in its own way, and we will simply have disappeared. So I think that those issues of destiny are really important, and that's why there's been such a difference between ISIS and the West. That when ISIS guys said, "You are afraid to die, we want to die," what their meaning is, we have a destiny, you do not. And that, in one sense, is why aspects of fundamentalism are important, not least with fundamentalism terms like the current president of America, who, in wanting to make America great again, is invoking a destiny factor. And this is invoking the city on a hill, this is the manifest destiny of America. So he is, in one sense, the most American of Americans.
Yeah.
At the very time when I noticed in the paper this very morning, actually, recent statistics on the decline of belief in the USA, which I've been thinking is going to happen for some years now. But the demise of destiny is one of the most interesting ways of thinking about your issue of nostalgia. Because the question of where does nostalgia, whatever it means, and it's a complex concept, where does it fit in that scheme of idea, value, belief, destiny? And I suppose the point I've been trying to make is that there are, for nostalgia, as for many other things in life, both positive and negative, creative and pathological ways of engaging with it.
Yeah. And to what extent would you say that, I mean, for me, growing up as I did very much in the sort of in the 1980s, I was born in the 70s and in the 80s and 90s, it was always interesting that there was always this sort of like demarcation between, you know, education and leisure. It's almost like, you know, you'd have to do a certain amount of homework, you'd go home and you'd do a certain number of hours of revision, you'd do all those things, and then you were allowed to play the piano or you were allowed to listen to the charts on the radio, whatever it might have been. And I found in later years that those thing, I mean, this is one of the joys of working in this sector, and you can cultivate your own sort of niche areas. And interviewing Vivian just earlier and her work on Slender Man sort of gives sort of sustenance to that. But I wondered the extent to which sometimes some of those, as we might conceive it, trivial pursuits might have actually had a more long-lasting effect on us. I'm just sort of thinking in that sense, musically, film, anything from your childhood that you've perhaps at the time really enjoyed, or maybe thought, I'm not allowed to enjoy this, or you know, maybe in later years you went back to and thought, actually, this kind of defines me, it defines an era, this is what I really engage with, this is in my DNA. Did you have any of those sort of experiences?
I don't think like that, really.
Yeah.
Because I think a conversation like this is about trains of thought and modes of being.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of train of thought and mode of being that I don't quite empathize with. Because the thought of having to do this before you could do that is something that doesn't ring true to me. I've always done what I've wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I've never been pressurized to do anything.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of a life in the circus kind of ringmaster approach, which I don't empathize with,
yeah.
really.
Yeah. I found I was giving a talk a few weeks ago, and somebody said, you know, how did you get to do what you're doing now? How did you become an academic? How did you write books and all the things you do? And I thought, well, I'm doing all this work on nostalgia. I need to trace it back. And I used to find that, and my parents used to despair of me, Sunday afternoon, I'd go to church in the morning, serve at my local Anglican church in Cardiff, go afternoon, 5 o'clock, I'd be writing down the top 40. And my parents were like, oh dear, you know, sort of, you know, better thing to do with your life. But the skills I found in doing that, I was categorising things, I was putting things into compartments, I was using different colours for all of that. A few years later in academia, I went back through all my old undergraduate notes. I was doing the same thing. I was using different colours, I was compartmentalising, I was categorising. But I couldn't divorce all of that from those music, from those films, from those earlier days. And so that's what I was more getting at. I think it's more that sometimes unconsciously, you know, things will seep into our consciousness. It's more like that music, that particular song, that particular, maybe a sporting event, it might be a sporting match that you remember, and it somehow it takes something, many years later you think, you know, I was there, I was privileged to witness that happen, or I was I was a witness at a primary event. That's more what I was getting at, and it's almost unconscious in that sense.
Yes, but you're talking about a kind of stream of consciousness approach to life, and of how some of those moments in the stream of consciousness are more significant than other moments are. But the thing about that is, if you approach life like that, then you tend, as you've just indicated, to box them up, to view them as special, to revisit them as special. And I suppose what I'm not empathizing with is the revisiting special moments. Because I think that that, in one sense, is what this nostalgia process is about. It's investing moments in the stream of consciousness with particular colours, significances. And any life has those. By definition, any life has those. But how you process them, how you handle them, is quite a different kind of thing. This is going to be the problem now for everybody who is photographing the world every 55 seconds. They will not live long enough to visually revisit all the photographs they've taken, in the same way that Japan must be sinking under the weight of photographs before they were digital, that the Japanese were taking all over the world. So there is an issue about the stream of consciousness in the terms of living in it, with it, rather than revisiting it. Perfectly possible to revisit all these things. There are obviously moments in everybody's life when you can go back and think about them, re-envisage them. But the question is whether that should become, whether it is wise for that to be a habit of mind or not. And if it is, what that does to the present. I mean, you can argue, for example, that one reason why old people remember the past so much is because there's so little new stimulating input that the brain has to play its older interesting content. And I think that is probably what goes on in the reminiscent mind, as it were. And maybe the nostalgic mind, where nostalgia is negatively valued. But it's perfectly possible, as Paul Witz is pursuing in his thesis, to look at nostalgia as an entirely positive, creative, adaptive phenomenon in an evolutionary way of looking at these things, rather than, as philosophically people often depict it, as a negative. They're big issues.
And that was going to be one of my questions about whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences, because you often use that term bittersweet, and I wonder if sometimes maybe there is this form of assimilation that goes on. Maybe it may be sort of reverse psychology, but we say, well, okay, that was a challenge, but we overcame that, therefore that's a positive thing. But do you think it is possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? I mean, from what you're saying as well, I mean, the whole issue about nostalgia and, you know, something that is positive as well, it's deeply problematic because it's all that sort of categorizing, and it's a sort of quite possibly sort of random event, perhaps. I don't know what you think.
I think in terms of basic emotions, and I think that what you're talking about is really a discussion of fear, that the revisiting of negative phenomena is to re-engage with fear. And that might be, some people might enjoy being afraid, but I wouldn't advocate that as a life stance.
Mm.
I think that's negative,
yeah.
Not a positive venture in terms of adaptive, creative mentality.
Mm. And what about that question, you know, when people will often ask, you know, have you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young, or do you still entertain thoughts about doing something different with your life? I mean, are these things, I mean, I often think that these things are involuntary, that sometimes, or it might be through one's children, that sometimes you think, oh, actually, my son or daughter has managed to achieve that goal, which I never did. No, that doesn't work for you.
No, that doesn't work for me.
Mm.
Again, this all depends on one of the great truths of sociology, which the great Emil Durkheim gave to us, was the idea of what he called homo duplex, the double person, by which he meant that society lives within us, and yet I am me. So the way in which I am me and society lives in me is the great issue of the social sciences, normally summed up in the phrase individual and society. And all disciplines play this out in different ways. So the English literature people play it out when they do criticism of a novel or of a film or whatever it happens to be. But how one works that seems to me to be quite crucial in understanding this issue that you've just highlighted of goal setting, goal acquisition, because it, in one sense, it's only if society puts into you that list of goals that you have to make, it says to you, that your me then has to play with those and think, have I done it? Will I do it? When shall I do it? Oh, I haven't done it. But that's one particular kind of mindset. And I think it's the major mindset of contemporary middle-class Britons. I don't think it's an evidence necessarily in working-class contemporary Britain, but it is a middle-class achievement motivation business. Yeah. And the education system is really responsible for that to a degree, and it's one reason why the British don't like the idea of apprenticeships, because the idea of apprenticeship has to do with skill acquisition, which is not the same thing as examination passing, because skill acquisition is about transformations of embodiment, to use that sort of sociological jargon. It's about the competence in being a three-dimensional organic entity, a thinking entity, which has a pleasure built into the act of doing. And there's a sense in which making a chair or growing tomatoes are not the same things as passing exams.
Mm-hmm.
And the distinction, to understand that distinction, is not easy, and contemporary Britain doesn't allow it to be the case. And it affects and infects vast swathes of life, from people thinking themselves too thin or too fat or not fit enough or something. It's all about these goals and boxes. And these are big issues.
No, and I remember some years ago teaching in a course where we were looking at theology of liberation, in that sense that we have this amazing privilege in the West that we can ask all these questions about theism or atheism, and yet there are some parts of the world where that is not it's about where's the next meal coming from.
I mean, precisely.
That, yeah, and I therefore wonder sometimes that we are perhaps overly indulgent, but I think also there's a whole industry in nostalgia. I mean, my own way into this was largely one whereby I couldn't work out at certain periods in my life where it felt that it's as if there was a door marked future that was ahead of me, but it was locked, or there was someone standing in front of it. So it was like, well, okay, well, I have to go to that one behind, where it all seemed to be a little bit too, like, well, I remember those carefully. And of course, I was very selective, because I was thinking about particular occasions, which were the antithesis of where I was in the present. But in a way, I thought I came to that organically, spontaneously, authentically, rather than one that was because we're fed a steady diet, let's be honest, of, you know, retro radio and TV programmes. I mean, you can't move for a sort of sounds of the 80s at the moment. You know, the 80s are utterly back in vogue. And I yet somehow thought that although what I'm doing is part of that same trajectory, I reached it through very idiosyncratic personal experiences. And I guess also the project is also trying to look for that universality in that approach as well, to say that, by which I mean, are other people going, you know, they may have different decades that they go back to, but are we all involved in that same sort of, maybe enterprise isn't the right word for it, but that same quest? And it is, and I wonder if sometimes it does feel almost eschatological, because I've done work on death and the afterlife, but somehow feeling the work on nostalgia is kind of an inversion of that, but it's also the same journey, because we're going back in order to go forwards.
What you're talking about there are cultural conventions and eras of conventions and how conventions change. And that must, of course, be true. It must, of course, be true for every society. And we can't predict what they're going to be. Because I guess there are very few who would have predicted that this particular decade would have been one in which the notion of experts and authorities would be questioned by many. The political situation throws this up dramatically. So predictive certainty is deeply problematic at the cultural level, I think. This is why sociologists are very good at critical commentary of the near past, but are pretty hopeless of the future. And that's an interesting way of approaching academic disciplines, really. And knowing what you're doing, and the predictive possibility of subjects should almost be an index of their value, if that is the way one is thinking about the nature and cause of things. Now, if you change the key signature entirely, or change the rules of the game entirely, and you now want to talk about what is the nature of wisdom then, then if you start to talk about what is the nature of wisdom then you're dealing with a different kind of situation than if you're talking about achievement, motivation, goals, perfection, misperfection, new goals, new stages to reach. And that is the great problem in contemporary Britain in terms of the thought world, that it dwells less on, though that isn't totally fair. I was going to say that it dwells more upon achievement than it does on concepts of wisdom. But that isn't true because, well, maybe this is a gendered issue, as many things are, not least in relation to life and death in particular. But I'm thinking of the role of novels and the extensive female writing and reading of novels in contemporary Britain. You could say, well, what's all that about then? And in one sense, what it's about, I guess, is taking us straight back to the role of stories, to the role of myths, to the role of seeing patterns in things, or reading oneself into the patterns of things. But I can't remember which of the weekend newspapers it is now, but one of them has a magazine, and in the magazine it has a section on called something like "What Have I Learned Then?" or "What Age Has Taught Me?" or something like that. And one of the great of the good sit there and do, in a sense, what you're talking about. They look back over their life and say, oh, I met this person, I heard that piece of music, I visited the Costa Brava, or whatever it was, and my life has never been the same since. sort of the what I have learned scenario. Well, whilst it's easy to be negative about that, turn it round and go back to that change of key signature. And what they're basically talking about is how they became wise. And it seems to me that that is the great issue for education, and that is, what is the point at which knowledge becomes transferred into wisdom? And that is the same issue as the difference between exam passing and apprenticeships completed. Because you get lots of those lovely works of art. It happens in silver, for example, where you get a piece that's probably the apprenticeship masterpiece that somebody has produced. And in a sense, what is it? Is it an exam that they've passed at one reading? On one reading, yes, you could say that. But at another level, it's an expression of embodied wisdom. Their hands now know what to do. In exactly the same way as in music, when people reach that level of accomplishment, that they are performers. And they are now, as it were, wise at. Jacques Lussier died recently, who made his reputation partly from playing Bach in terms of jazz. That's very interesting that he did it. So that was a kind of a Lussier, that was Lussier's wisdom, that he achieved that, which is very different from somebody having learned to play a piece of Bach to pass level X in music. It seems to me they are the important ways of talking, because what we really are discussing here, we're discussing ways of talking, which are about ways of thinking, and trying to do it without slipping into the ways of talking and the ways of thinking that are standard in academic-y, intelligent worlds or something.
Yeah. And I've got one more question for you. Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward person? I kind of feel that you've sort of answered that question. I'm probably asking the wrong question, but it's one that I ask in all the interviews.
Neither.
Okay.
Is the answer to that. Neither is the answer to that. Because whilst it seems to me that you inevitably look back, you meet family, you meet friends, you are with them, you talk about things that have happened. Therefore, social life demands that you look back, or you refer back. Maybe there's a difference between referring back to things that have happened, oh, do you remember when we were, kind of thing, than looking back, which would invoke that kind of deep, perceptive, focused consideration business. No, and looking forward seems to me to be something that, of course, we also do. What am I going to do next week? What does my diary tell me I have agreed to do next week? All that sort of thing. But to adopt either the looking back or the looking forward model would seem to me, in light of what I was just saying, to be slightly foolish, because as many a philosopher has said, we only actually live in the present. The present is all I know. The present is all I, in one sense, am and have. So it is being in the present that is what life is essentially about. But the problem, I think, that many people have in living in the present is they're so obstructed by the past and so anxious about the future. So we are back again to emotions, theory of emotions, and the extent to which our life circumstances, because you alluded earlier on to different times and places, and the way I'm talking now is a way of talking that has to understand itself as talking in a safe society. I don't have to worry about dinner or where I'm going to sleep tonight. I don't have to worry about that. If I did, then I would be living in the future almost entirely. And I think that's one reason why, for example, so many people who've lived in hazardous worlds, whether they were in the German concentration camps or whether they were part of a revolution somewhere or terrorism somewhere. The fact that they've survived leads them to live positively into the future in a way in which those of us in safe society even don't have to think of doing.
Yeah. And Douglas Davis, what a wonderful, very wise, actually, you talked about wisdom earlier in the conversation, but you've made me very much reconceptualize my own way of dealing with this material. So thank you very much.
Pleasure.